Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week we're talking about class with researcher Danny Dorling, the Lib Dems with our politics team, and the recent elections in Iceland with our contributing editor Laurie Penny. I'm joined by our political editor Raphael Baer and the editor of The Staggers, Georgia Eaton, to talk about the politics and the big issues of the week. First up, the Lib Dems. Raph, where are they?
They are not doing terribly well in the opinion polls, as everyone can see, but they are, their mood is more buoyant than I think a lot of people think it ought to be. And I've written my column about that this week. I'll give that a quick plug. But the reason is, the thesis that I was trying to follow is that, I mean, everyone's been talking about Nigel Farage and UKIP, this great insurgency. It's all terribly exciting, sort of new actor on the stage, it seems. But actually, the sort of the force that's really changed the way politics operates, the things that when we kind of look back on the history of this parliament, we'll go, wow, that was actually something quite substantial happening in the way everyone had to behave in politics, will be coalition and Nick Clegg. And one of the reasons for that, one of the sort of remarkable things, is that he's still there and they're still going. And they got creamed in the local election results recently. I mean, they lost sort of 120, 124 councillors. They came seventh in the South Shields by-election with sort of 2% of the vote, which is not a good result by anyone's book. And yet, when you speak to the Lib Dems, or you certainly speak to Lib Dems around Nick Clegg, what they will say is, look, we're never going to get a Labour stronghold like South Shields. We are not going to be a receptacle of protest vote anymore, but actually, in places where we have a sitting MP, where the machine is still working, people who are used to seeing combat in terms of blue, yellow, stop the Tories, they're still coming out for us. They're still coming out for the Lib Dems. And what that means is when the sort of the Labour Tory battle feels like the sort of the Western Front, sort of circa 1916, and they're just stuck in these muddy trenches, you know, advancing a bit, retreating a bit. It's just all sort of mud and corpses. Actually, the opportunity for the Lib Dems, with a degree of strategic clarity that I think they deserve some credit for, to just squat in the middle and have another hung parliament, which everyone I speak to seems to think is the likeliest outcome of the next general election, and then be possibly in another coalition and have a second term in government. And yeah, the Tories aren't expecting that necessarily, and Labour getting very pessimistic about their chances of a majority. So actually, Clegg's survival bigger than Farage's arrival.
It's a good rhyme. So for the next 2 years, what do they look like for the Lib Dems? Are they just going to be there just to block things like the Snoopers Charter, for example? Or are there any shreds of yellow policy that is, you know, I didn't think we heard anything in the Queen's speech, did we?
Well, the sense I'm getting is that the next 2 years are basically election campaign. And that is, it actually seems to be the Conservatives who are driving that. They recognise that because in terms of holding some kind of party unity together, fending off a UKIP threat. What they really want to now do is use Parliament, any opportunity they can, any mechanism they can, sort of advertise the sorts of things they would do if only they didn't have these pesky Lib Dems on their back. And in that context, that makes it quite hard for the Lib Dems to do anything but block. But really, I mean, going back to what I was saying before, if the market for Lib Dems is people who think, well, you know, fair play to them, they're still there, they're not mad, and actually what we don't want is a Conservative majority government, because actually those guys are a bit mad, especially when they go galloping after UKIP voters, sort of keeping the Lib Dems there as a sort of the leash on the Tory dog, it's a not implausible proposition. I wouldn't overstate this. I mean, God, they struggle to sustain double digit in the polls. but you're not hearing so much the idea that Nick Clegg can't possibly lead them into the next election. And they have their own manifesto process, and they will go into the next election saying, look, there are three or four big things, you know, the income tax, threshold rising, or don't challenge me to name any other great Lib Dem achievements, because then my thesis starts to unravel a bit. But anyway, they will go into the next election saying, look, we took the edge off the Tories. We delivered a popular policy, which is a tax cut. And frankly, you know, we're the tonic in that bathtub gin.
And George, we had a diary this week from UKIP leader Nigel Farage. Farage, as I believe we're supposed to pronounce it now. What's your sense of how he's played things after his unexpectedly great result?
It's very interesting that Farage, on the one hand, is trying to build UKIP up as the fourth party of British politics, talking of a seismic shift. On the other hand, he's suggesting that there could be some kind of arrangement with the Conservatives in the future. If David Cameron departs as leader, he said he'd be open to working with Michael Gove, he'd be open to working with Boris Johnson. You've now got, of course, some people on the Tory side, Jacob Rees-Mogg, most notably, saying that there should be some kind of coalition with UKIP. Farage, he said, should become Deputy Prime Minister. Tory voters would much prefer him to Nick Clegg. Presumably, that's after he's gone to the trouble of actually winning a seat. But I think, look, Farage, he will get another, there will be another surge next year when they do very well in the European elections. I think they're slightly raising expectations by suggesting they're certain to win them. They've got a good chance, but there's still a chance Labour could win and UKIP come a very strong second. So the test for Farage as a leader will be whether he can actually begin to manage the expectations.
One of the things that I find most interesting is the mood at the moment, this idea that UKIP are an anti-establishment party. And I pointed this out in the Sunday Politics, that this is somebody who went to a private school, who was a stockbroker. He's not, you know, he's hardly kind of some hippie who's wandered in completely, you know, off beam. Is there a sense, do you think, and maybe we can't solve political journalism in the next minute and a half, but that politicians and journalists are having a conversation which normal people are excluded from?
I think there's two things going on here. One, certainly I'll add to that Stuart Wheeler, who's the treasurer of UKIP and his key financier, who went Eton, Oxford, the city. And, you know, you think, well, it's not that anti-establishment, is it? But there is a feeling, I think, among a lot of politicians and a lot of political journalists that because they have this same, very similar background, they aren't entitled to speak on behalf of working class people, you know, in quotes, ordinary, normal people. And so they sort of desperately want, as it were, a sort of a piece of that anti-establishment action. They want to be able to articulate that, but actually they know they can't do it authentically. And it's almost that kind of self-loathing translated into, sort of projected onto UKIP. And I do think it's a dangerous theme to pursue, because actually what UKIP, before they're anti-establishment, what they are is anti-immigrant. I mean, the establishment is not made up of Bulgarian migrants. You know? So let's think about what they actually oppose, what the thing they hate, which is a lot of modern Britain and a lot of foreigners, the thing they like, the past. And then the establishment is a second-order issue.
And you were looking at the polling this week, George, about what it is that motivates UKIP voters. Mm. And we've actually discovered that they don't really... Europe is not the big thing that A, motivates them to vote, and B, is all that big of an issue anyway, right?
Absolutely. I mean, for them, the most important issue, as it is for most voters, is the economy and then immigration. But I think it is this wider sense of UKIP as the plucky upstarts against the establishment. You're right that Farage makes a very unlikely figurehead for that revolt. One UKIP voter said to me recently, I like UKIP, you know, they want to sort out the bankers. I mean, Farage was a banker. I mean, they are the most pro-city party in British politics. But it's because he speaks in this populist patter that Miliband and Cameron can't match. There is one figure the Tories have who can do some of that, who's Boris Johnson. It'll be very interesting to see how they deploy Boris against Farage and whether Cameron can recruit Boris as an ally in his bid to counter the UKIP threat.
And is there a sense, in either of you, that there's anybody in the Labour Party who can talk to people in that way?
Well, I think this is a big problem for Labour, because actually Ed Miliband, a part of his sort of self-image and the proposition he offered was, you know, the ripper-up of the rules, you know, breaking the mould, a sort of seismic shift in British politics. And he sort of calculated that this is where politics was going to go after the financial crisis. And in his sort of computer model, in his sort of spreadsheet, he didn't have right-wing populist insurgency on the page. And that means the basic political equation that he's put together in terms of his strategy of what he can represent in British politics is wrong. And I think that's actually intellectually profoundly challenging to what Labour is offering. And actually, you look at the Labour front bench, and no, it's very hard to see who could sort of perform in the way that Farage is able to perform.
But there was this theory, we were talking about this last week, that Labour voters would defect to UKIP in the way that they, so some people would just never consider doing to the Tories. Although we know that already that they're stealing more Tory voters than Labour voters.
It certainly looks at the moment that what's happening is Labour are stuck, but they've got a bunch of Lib Dem refugees and, you know, anti-Tory voters, and then the Tory votes for them because a lot of people are switching. That's a broad underlying point. But I do think also there are a lot of people who, you know, were fed up with Labour for quite a long time because they're in government for a long time, and are also anti-immigration and anti-Europe. And as, you know, George was saying, they're not as inoculated against voting UKIP as they are against voting Tory.
And George, I've spent a couple of wasted hours of my life trying to find out exactly what the detail of this kind of crackdown on immigration that was in the Queen's speech. What does it amount to?
They're going to make it much harder for immigrants to use the NHS. And if they do, they're going to make sure the NHS can claim those payments back. They're going to be conditions on social housing, so residency tests, which a lot of councils already apply. Actually, a lot of what they're doing is already in place. Mm. It's just a case of sending a signal to the right of the party, look, we're doing something. We're aware that, you know, this is something you're concerned about, that UKIP are winning support over.
This is going to say on that, this is a disastrous strategy, because all the history has always shown that what happens is people aren't going to believe it's working, but you're completely reinforcing the impression that it's a terrible problem. So what you're essentially doing is advertising yourselves as the people who would like to do what UKIP say they want to do, but don't have the guts or the capability, which is basically a way of saying, go vote UKIP.
We had this Andrew Ozzie's column at the weekend, you know, you can't out UKIP the kippers or whatever it was. But no, I think we had a blog from Alex Andre that said that this estimated kind of cost of NHS is £20 million pounds from foreign non-EEA nationals using it. What would be the administration cost of every GP having to check everybody's passport, you know, when they came into the surgery? It's kind of... But you're right, it's dog whistling and not.
And expecting GPs to refuse, essentially say, well, sorry, before I see you, can I see your passport, please? I mean, most doctors I know would feel very uncomfortable doing that.
Well, I just don't see how there's any way that an A&E department, somebody can walk in with their leg hanging off and they can say no.
They can't walk in if their leg is hanging off.
They can hop in with their leg hanging off.
Practical issue there.
But anyway, on that note, I'll leave you. Thank you very much, George and Rev.
Danny Dorling is the Professor of Human Geography at Sheffield University, and he's written a piece about social mobility in the magazine this week, and he's here with me now. Danny, in a line, if it's possible to do, what would you say has happened to social mobility in this country? I mean, your piece's prediction or assessment of where we are and where we're going to be is pretty bleak.
It doesn't look good at the moment. It does look good if you look back a long way, which is what I do in the piece. So I go all the way back to the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, social mobility increased as the gap between us narrowed from the 20s until the 1970s. But since the late 1970s, the gaps between us in terms of income and wealth and opportunity have been widening and widening. And at the moment, there is no sign that widening isn't going to carry on. And it's got back to pre-war levels of inequality.
Yeah, I mean, well, we'll come back to that, the sort of the pre-war, post-war sort of disjuncture, because that's very interesting. But one thing that you do really deftly in the piece is framing the story through Margaret Thatcher's family and her trajectory through the class system, I suppose. And I wonder if you could just sort of give us a brief insight into that. And I mean, obviously, the timing was close after her death, but what gave you that idea?
People always say about Margaret Thatcher, quite often say, how she came from supposedly common stock and wasn't she not like the party she joined. But that was partly a story of the times she lived through. It was easier for somebody from her background to rise than it is now. And also her background wasn't that poor. When she was born, her father was a shop owner. That puts you above many other people. By the time she got into her 20s, he owned two shops. The second one was a bit much of a shack, but it was still two shops, and he became mayor. So she was really in the top 1% in her town of Grantham when she went to university. But her kind of trajectory up the social scale was something that was much more common at that time and became much less common from the point she became Prime Minister onwards. And it's a kind of modern tale of our times, is Margaret Thatcher's life and then what she did and her colleagues did when they were in power, in effect, to make it harder for other people to move around in the way that they had.
Yeah, it's the sort of central irony, isn't it? I mean, you cite 1979 as being this sort of turning point year. But go back to the war and that post-war moment, I suppose, which did see a real sea change, obviously, in the sort of social makeup of Britain.
It really was a big change. So many things all happened at once. You had free secondary education brought in with the 1944 Act. You had a health service brought in that allowed you not to live in fear. But you also had a change in attitudes. It had begun before the war. It began in the austerity of the 1930s. But the war cemented the change, so people no longer saw each other as so different between the social classes, partly because they had fought side by side together. And also had to imagine the end of British, or at least English, society. It could have come to an end in the war. And that, I think, changes what you see as solid and what you think is as fixed at all time. And that those changes carried on in the 1950s and the 1960s, when people at the top of society took smaller increases in their pay than people at the bottom of society. So as we got full employment, as living conditions got better, the gaps between ourselves in terms of our wages and salaries dropped, and the wealth gaps dropped, and so it became easier and easier to mix socially, because the actual real gaps, the gaps of really money, gaps in terms of money, became much, much less than they had been before the war.
Yeah, and I mean, do you lay the blame for what happened later on then, squarely or purely at Thatcher's door, or is it more complicated than that?
It's more complicated. It's not just one person or even one political party that you can hold responsible. I think what you can do is to look at the trajectories in many countries. And the key thing about Britain is that we went a particular way in the 1970s that most other countries in Europe didn't go. They may have seen small increases in inequality and in the gaps between people rising, but nothing like the increase that we saw. And in hindsight, it really was all the way from the late 60s through the 70s that this kind of decision was being made about which way we were going to go. And I think it's fair enough to blame the 1960s Labour governments and the fact they didn't put in place a strife into practice, as happened in much of mainland Europe, as much as the Conservatives who saw this as an opportunity to look after their own, or the group that they'd got solidly into, in the case of Margaret Thatcher, and to saw away allowing the inequality.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
To rise. It was a national decision, or a national failure, depending on how you look at it, right across the political spectrum, compared to those countries in most of Europe or in Scandinavia, which kept the achievements of the 1940s, 50s and 60s largely intact into the 80s and 90s, and so are much more all in it together now that we have a international crisis hitting us again.
And the sort of final section of your piece is really, I mean, it's distressing reading, really, when you're examining the entrenchment of really an absolute poverty, of you know, the idea at that the lowest end that there are plenty of people in Britain now, and we know because we see food banks opening, etc., that are not properly fed and whose children are not properly fed. And I suppose, as a last question, you know, what now? What can be done and what isn't being done, more to the point, to rectify this?
Well, what's happening now at the bottom of society, I mean, half of people are financially insecure, a third living in some kind of poverty. Housing conditions are getting absolutely worse. People are getting colder in their homes because they can't heat them. Number of children who are not eating properly is rising. All of this can only happen in a rich country which has become so disconnected from itself, in which the gaps between people have grown so wide that it can be seen as allowable that we have a situation where food banks, where basically soup kitchens from the 1930s return again. My view is that I cannot see any country in the world, any rich country in the world, that has as big a gap between the rich and the poor, which then manages to solve its problems of poverty. the only countries in which you see poverty reducing, in which you see things getting absolutely better at the bottom, are those countries where the rich are not taking more and more of what there is to go around. So I can see no way in which we will get rid of the food banks and the soup kitchens and the people going cold in their homes again in the way that their parents didn't, without curtailing the excesses at the top and without having a situation where our top 1% are taking twice as much as the top 1% in, say, places like Switzerland or the Netherlands, which are actually far more equal than we are.
Thank you very much, Danny. That's fascinating.
I'm joined by our contributing editor, Laurie Penny, down the line from a conference in Germany. Hello, Laurie.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I wanted to talk to you about your feature, which you've written in this week's magazine, about the elections in Iceland, which happened on the 27th of April. First of all, tell me, it was your first time in Iceland, so what was it like to visit as a country?
It's a very strange and fascinating place. I really, really like being there. I wish I could have stayed longer, actually, because Reykjavik is the main town, and it's so cosmopolitan and yet so small and so far away from everything.
You say in the piece, don't you, it's 320,000 people, yes. About the size of Reading.
Yeah, that's the whole country, not Reykjavik. Reykjavik is the size of Southend. It's very, very little.
And then, so in the elections, I think, you know, there were just hundreds of people standing from this tiny population. But you write in the piece about the idea of this kind of fairy tale that we tell ourselves, that Iceland turned away from austerity, it broke all the rules.
Yeah.
And to how much, to what extent is that true?
Well, it's not as true as we would like. But when you explain this to people, especially when people from Iceland try and explain this to anyone else in the Eurozone, people actually get angry. Apparently, the Spanish consulate in Reykjavik has apparently been receiving phone calls from Spaniards desperate to emigrate to Iceland, a socialist utopia. And they get really, really upset when they're told that actually it's not as simple as that. You know, that people have problems there as well. And actually, people have massive problems with the government, massive problems with the system of representation. And people's lives aren't great right now. There's still poverty. There's still a drop in the quality of life. And this is still the result of massive financial mismanagement, out of control free market capitalism. And people are still dealing with the effects of that. They're just dealing with it in a slightly different way from many other countries in the world.
And you write particularly about the Pirate Party. Now, people kind of might have heard the phrase, but probably I don't think we'll have much of a clue about them. Can you bring them to life for us?
Well, the Pirate Party started, they came out of the Pirate Bay, the file sharing site based in Sweden. When that started being attacked, people involved in those file sharing sites started to get together and think, hang on, we need somebody in power to represent our interests. And out of that quite niche issue of time came everything that the Pirates are about now, which is direct democracy, freedom of speech, and they are still a niche issue party, which is what I find very, very interesting about them, because they're acting in the same space as other political parties, but they don't have the same intentions. They're not also the same as a single issue group, rather like the Green Party in the UK. I guess their ideas are broadened out a bit beyond what the initial impetus was. They're also all nerds.
I like that line about being allergic to inaccuracy, because they love data. They love, and actually they seem to be doing a similar thing to some of the initiatives here, like the They Work For You and those kind of things, where you can track what, you know, much more detail what your MP is doing, what they're saying on your behalf.
Absolutely. There are already sites in the UK which mirror things that the Pirate Party is doing. They Work For You would be an example. The idea is that we use the internet to make a democratic system that's much more representative, much fairer. And a lot of these ideas are actually very old ideas that have been updated for the internet age. But whether or not they're going to work is still being tested out. Pirates assure me that they've got protocols in place, so people can't just, you know, vote for free ponies for everyone and then we have to do it, because that would be silly.
And let's just flagrantly spoiler the end of your piece, because you end up at 4 a.m. in a downtown Reykjavik bar,
yes,
listening to some pounding techno with the Pirate Party. But they got three members of parliament in the end.
They got three, and that's the first Pirate Party MPs in a national government. So it's quite historic. But the next day, everybody wasn't really that happy, which I was quite impressed with, because, yes, they got in, but so had the Progressive and the Independence Party, who were the big centre-right and right-wing parties in Iceland, which were responsible for their financial crash in the first place. So obviously, everybody on the left, and on the pirates, not necessarily of the left, but everybody on the left in Iceland has massive work to do in even bringing the country back to where it was before the elections.
Well, Laurie, it sounded a little bit like you're in a cross between a kind of busy airport and a squeaky hospital cafeteria. So I think we'll probably leave it there. But thank you very much, and I hope you'll be back on the podcast soon.
Thanks, Helen. Nice to talk to you.
My name's Philip Morn, and I'm joined by Jonathan Derbyshire to talk about the week's books. Edmund Burke, Jesse Norman, has written a biography of Burke, philosopher, politician, prophet. And this week we have a review in the magazine by John Gray, who sort of takes issue with the way that Burke is being manhandled in this book, I think.
Yeah, so Jesse Norman, Conservative MP, recently readmitted into the Cameroonian fold after being in the political equivalent of Siberia for the last couple of years, has written, it's not just a biography of Burke, it's also an attempt to treat Burke as a political philosopher whose work has contemporary resonances. Mm. John Gray's principal contention in this review is that there's a fundamental contradiction in Burke's work, which Norman doesn't take sufficient account of, and that contradiction hobbles Norman's attempt to present us with a Burke for the 21st century, if you like. So the tension, as I understand it, is between Burke's critique of what has subsequently been called by the conservative political philosopher Michael Oakeshott political rationalism. In other words, Burke was very critical of the idea, and this is why he was so horrified by the French Revolution. He was very critical of the idea that societies could be remade in the image of abstract ideals. So on the one hand, you've got this anti-rationalism in politics that is very characteristic of Burke's masterpiece, his reflections on the French Revolution. Yet, John says, he was also at the same time committed to a kind of providentialism, which saw the progress of liberty as evidence of there being a divine author of history at work. And John suggests that providentialism is in tension, irresolvable tension with Burke's critique of political rationalism. And that hobbles, as I've said, Norman's attempt to suggest that we might have more to learn from Burke, who, of course, was writing in the mid to late 18th century, than we might have thought.
Mm. And he spends quite a lot of time talking about Thatcher, actually, because I think one of the sort of side effects of writing this book is that he's sort of written the Thatcherite model out of conservative history. I think that's quite an interesting point to make.
Yeah, so he sees Burke as a critic of liberal individualism. Mm. And, of course, as Simon Heffer argued in his essay in The New Statesman last week, it is entirely plausible to see Thatcher not as a conservative, but as a kind of Gladstonian liberal and tribune of liberal individualism. However, there is a connection, Gray suggests, between Thatcher and Burke, is that Thatcher, like Burke, saw the progress of liberty as fitting into a kind of grand historical narrative. But as John says, unfortunately, the narrative has came to a juddering halt with the financial crisis of 2008, which brought the great Thatcherite project of the last 30 years to an end.
Precisely. And there's a nice quote I've picked out here where he says that absolute consistency, however desirable in mathematics and logic, is neither available nor desirable in the conduct of human affairs. Yeah. So while, of course, the lady wasn't for turning, and Burke is most famous for having turned on his initial sort of radical commitment with regards to politics. There's also a review by Sarah Churchwell, quite a rigorous review when it comes to history. It's a new novel about Zelda Fitzgerald, a historical novel, which sort of is lacking in history as she sees it.
Yeah, I don't think Sarah would mind me suggesting that she's grinding an axe or two in this review, because as listeners will know, Sarah is about to publish a book entitled Careless People, Murder, Mayhem and the Invention of the Great Gatsby, and it's published by Little Brown in June. Her fundamental complaint with this novel, which, as you've said, by Therese Anne Fowler, which, is, as you said, is based on the life of Zelda and indeed F. Scott Fitzgerald, is that the author, Therese Anne Fowler, has not met her obligations to the historical record. I think the concluding paragraph of Sarah Churchwell's review summarises the argument very well. She writes, "Writers of historical novels owe a debt to the facts that have inspired their fictions. Fowler wants to capitalise on the facts but feels no obligation to them." And much of the viewer is taken up with a really punishing enumeration of the myriad historical errors that litter the novel.
Absolutely. Lovely to read about Zelda Fitzgerald in amongst all this Gatsby madness at the moment. Norman Lamont has reviewed a book about Iran. It's a very interesting review that he expects the book to be attacked for its almost support of, well, understanding towards the Iranian situation with regard to nuclear power.
Yeah, so the book in question is A Dangerous Delusion, Why the West is Wrong About Nuclear Iran, by the right-wing commentator Peter Oborne and David Morrison. And indeed, Norman Lamont, former Conservative Chancellor of the Exchequer, and also, it ought to be pointed out, Chairman of the British Iranian Chamber of Commerce. full disclosure.
Yeah.
Norman Lamont writes that he expects that the wrath of the neocons is about to descend upon Oborne and Morrison. And that's because Oborne and Morrison, in this brief but very well argued book, consider the evidence for the claim being made by the Americans and other international powers that Iran's nuclear program has been turned to military ends. And Lamont notes, as Oborne and Morrison argue, that the evidence tends rather to suggest that Iran is not engaged in developing a nuclear weapon. And he suggests that it's time for the West to start talking to the Iranians, just as they've learned to talk, however distasteful they may find the regime to the Chinese.
Yeah. No, there are a lot of points made in this that I think get lost in the sort of more hysterical wings of the newspapers and the press. He talks about the International Atomic Energy Agency and the constant pressure that they are under, mostly from Western governments, to kind of persuade Iran to constantly come up with what Lamont writes as various negatives. You know, this is actually a great deal of pressure and something that is undoubtedly going to wind up the government.
And he also points out that it's something that's not sufficiently acknowledged in the debates on this issue, is that Iran's nuclear facilities do operate under the supervision of the IAEA.
The biologist Steve Jones has got a new book called The Serpent's Promise, The Bible Retold as Science, which is, of course, a very provocative title. And as our reviewer Nick Spencer from the think tank Theos points out, this is the kind of title that's going to sell a science book nowadays, whether it has bears great relation to the contents of the book is actually in question.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a fundamental problem with this book is that it takes for granted something that Spencer says we ought not to take for granted, which it takes for granted the claim that the Bible and Christianity more generally contains an account of the nature of reality and the way the world is that is in some sense a rival to the account of the way the world is offered by natural science. But as Nick points out, he writes, the Bible shows little curiosity about subjects we normally place under the rubric of science, such as the origin, age, structure and diversity of the physical world. And Nick Spencer comes close to suggesting that the book is almost a kind of cynical marketing ploy, because when Jones forgets about religion and simply attends to offering very fluent, popularising explanations of fundamental scientific principles, having to do, for example, with the origins of the universe, the origins of life, evolution, the interaction of nature and nurture, and so on. He shows himself one of our best science popularisers. The problem is that science popularising has been put in the service of a rather tendentious argument about the nature of religion and the relationship between religion and science.
Indeed, and to write about the Bible, you would hope to read a great deal of parts of psychology, myth and so on, and these are going to be missing. So it's, you know, a matter of great when he's writing about science, not so great when he isn't.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
You are listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Helen Lewis, and our regular New Statesman staff are Philip Morn, George Eaton, Raphael Baer and Sophie Elmhurst. This was the last podcast appearance for culture editor Jonathan Derbyshire, and we wish him all the best in his new role at Prospect.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.